You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up for news media, covering elections always comes with challenges, but the unique situation with this year's pandemic means there's a lot more for journalists to think about. Our guest has recommendations for the media and for people watching for results. Now, last night, after the U.S. Senate voted 52-48, Judge Amy Coney Barrett was sworn in as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court.
The oath that I have solemnly taken tonight means at its core that I will do my job without any fear or favor, and that I will do so independently of both the political branches and of my own preferences.
With just 7 days now until the end of voting in this year's presidential race, this is the first time a justice has been confirmed this close to an election. We're talking now about last night's vote and taking a look at the politics of the Supreme Court and the confirmation process. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the much anticipated decision last night by the Senate to confirm Judge Barrett? Do you think that it should have held off till after Election Day or Inauguration Day? What are your hopes and or fears for what the new court could bring? Call in at 800-642-1234. And you vote based in part on who is going to get nominated to the Supreme Court. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Owens is with us, professor of political science and affiliate faculty at the UW Law School. He studies law, courts, and American political institutions. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet.
Well, no surprise here, a almost completely party line vote in the U.S. Senate. What do you think about the process that got us here, first of all?
Well, it's a fairly typical political process. I know there's a lot of thunder and lightning about this particular nomination and the process in which it occurred. But frankly, it's a standard political process that we've seen in the past, certainly not this close to the election, but it's a political process. And when a president of one party and a Senate of that same party are in control, this is what we see more often than not.
And what do you think this is going to mean for some of the big issues that are going to be coming to the court over the next couple of weeks and over the next year or so?
Well, I think the real question is just the long game. I know that Senate Democrats focused a lot on the Affordable Care Act and the confirmation process, frankly, because I think they didn't have a whole lot else to go on in terms of her confirmation, her background. And I think they wanted to try to score political points for the election, and that was a good issue for them. But really, I think when we talk about these nominations and confirmations, we really have to think about the long term here. And I think, she will be I suspect she will be a fairly humble justice. She'll probably, follow the text as it's written. I don't see her as somebody who's going to jump out immediately and try to take down precedents that she might disagree with. I think she will be a fairly steady, moderately conservative justice on the court.
A big question in these hearings is, I think everybody in the public and a lot of people in the Senate want to know how a judge is going to vote on issues. And that's the one thing that nominee wants to talk about. And they want to talk about, more the what you were just talking about, the attitude toward how to interpret the Constitution. Does it end up feeling, not just with disappointment, a little unsatisfying to not get what people, I think, mostly want to hear?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is, it's tricky, it's complex. Democrats in this instance wanted to know, how are you going to vote in this case? And she said, I'm not going to tell you. In previous nominations, Republicans want to know the same thing. Everybody feigns indignation. And it's just sort of nonsense. I think the concern about not wanting to show, a bias one way or the other on behalf of the nominee, I think that's actually a good thing. I understand people are worried about it getting out of hand, but I certainly think that's a good thing. But there are plenty of questions that senators could ask during these procedures, like, what do you believe the proper role of a law clerk is? How do you believe justices should interpret foreign sources of law? Somebody brought that in at one point. What do you think about the judicial hierarchy? Questions like that, I think, are not specific to particular cases, but nevertheless shed light on a particular justice and how they view their role in the judiciary.
I want to give a listen to Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri talking about Amy Coney Barrett's nomination and one big issue that people will be watching for, I'm sure. Here's a listen.
The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett is truly historic. This is the most openly pro-life judicial nominee to the Supreme Court in my lifetime. This is an individual who has been open in her criticism of that illegitimate decision, Roe versus Wade.
And this Roe versus Wade has been a big bone of contention, obviously a big prize, I think, for people trying to overturn it. Do you see it being opened up for reconsideration at some point? A lot of states are passing laws that could take us there. Is that something you're watching for?
Not in the short run. You know, I think her personal predilections are definitely pro-life, and that's fine. I mean, you know, there are many millions of conservatives each year who go to the polls for that particular reason. The question, I think, is whether or not she's going to get on the court and immediately try to, you know, reverse existing precedent out there. I don't see that happening. I can see in the midterm, maybe long term, they pick at the edges a little bit of Roe versus Wade. You know, maybe down the road they'll reconsider it or something. But I don't see this as something that's going to happen immediately. You know, much to the fear of many people, I just don't see it happening in the short run here.
We're talking to Wisconsin political scientist Ryan Owens from UW's Law School, looking at last night's confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the process, the issues before the court? What are your thoughts on the legal opinions of Judge Coney Barrett and the impact she might have on the court? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison political scientist Ryan Owens. Last night, President Trump's third nominee to the Supreme Court was confirmed by the Senate. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the confirmation, the timing, the issues it could affect, and how it affects the presidential race, whether it affects your vote in a presidential race? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls we go. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi, hello. I kind of reject the term pro-life myself. I think it's about a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body, and that is seems like a fundamental right of an individual to control their own person. So, and who's anti-life? So I reject the term pro-life, and I don't agree either that this is a moderately conservative justice when people have reported that she is as conservative, if not more so, than former Supreme Court Judge Scalia, who was considered very conservative. So, and then to do this while there's an election taking place, 50 million people have already voted before they confirm this justice. This is historic for reasons of sheer power, just power. This is not what the American people want. Before, they are always, you know.
Willem, I gotcha. You gave us a lot to work with there. First of all, where she falls on the conservativeness scale of Supreme Court justices, Ryan, I've seen different people try to put that, to measure that. What do we know about that?
Well, the thing is, you can't know yet, because being a circuit court judge is fundamentally different than being a Supreme Court justice. You have to follow precedent. You're bound by your own circuit's rules. So, she has not had, I want to say a free hand, but she's not had the ability to act like a justice. And so we just don't know. A lot of times you put people on the court. You know, I can remember back when everybody thought David Souter was going to be this reflexive right winger, and look what happened there. So you have to take those, shrieks with a grain of salt. Now, as to the historic thing, millions of people have voted, this has to wait. I mean, I can certainly understand why people think that way, but look, the fact of the matter is, when you have control of the reins of government, you implement those. And, it's difficult, because what are you supposed to do? Let's say you're the president, right? And there's an election coming around. I mean, you're not going to hobble yourself and say, well, I'm not going to make a decision right now because people are going to go to the polls in a few months. Where does that line get drawn where, oh, gosh, it's so close to the election, we can't act. To think that a party in this situation would not do, you know, what Republicans did here, I think is just crazy. You know, Democrats, had they had their druthers, they would do the same thing. And if you look back on history, as I said earlier, parties have done this in the past. This is absolutely commonplace. And, you know, I mean, during the confirmation hearings, we heard a lot of senators say, this process is a sham. It's illegitimate. That is absolutely wrong. It's false. You know, I think Democrats oftentimes attack President Trump for his comments about the potential illegitimacy of an election and say that that's not helpful. I also think that, you know, Senate Democrats, when they attack this process as being illegitimate itself, was very, very unhelpful. It's just politics. You may not like it, but that doesn't make it illegitimate.
I think the critique was Republicans who had said with Merrick Garland, don't do this months before an election. And yes, it was divided government, but I don't think there's that asterisk. They said, don't do it in a presidential election year. I think like Democrats have really highlighted that contrast.
Yeah, right. So, you know, what they could have done then is they could have just pushed the nomination through and then they could have excoriated him. You know, in the confirmation hearings, it could have trumped up things and, you know, engage in a personal assassination of him to strike it down. I don't think that would have been helpful either. The fact of the matter is just historically, if you look at this, when you have divided government during this time period, the confirmation process, you know, slows down. Joe Biden did the same thing in 1991. This is just how it works. And people aren't I think they haven't studied history enough to know that this happens. And so they're very keen to buy into the argument that this is brand new and, you know, a revolutionary and the like. I mean, I can certainly understand why people are upset on the left that Republicans are going to get a third nomination. But again, that doesn't make the process illegitimate. It just makes it a process that you dislike.
Let's go back to our callers. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hi, how are you? I totally disagree with your guest, Dr. Owen's evaluation of this justice. I think she is a Joan of Arc. I think she has a mission. Think about it. She went to all kinds of very seemly or seamy events featuring her as a prize catch and knowing all the political hopes that were put upon her, still went through the process. And the Supreme Court is supposed to be the ultimate forum for fairness. Now, there can be great disagreement about what's fair or not, but it's about fairness. And so she put herself into this cauldron of political sliminess, and I think that's because she feels that she has a mission, and she's going to...
Thanks a lot for the call. Saul thinks she, Ryan, will have a much bigger impact and want to make an impact soon.
Yeah. So, I mean, the notion, you know, that she, I'm not sure what Saul is talking about with, you know, seamy events. Her background looks exactly like all recent nominees to the high court. So I'm not sure precisely what he's talking about there, but I do think, you know, she will have an effect on the court, right? I mean, the conservatives for a very long time have been stymied first by, you know, a Lewis Powell, then a Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and then, you know, John Roberts. And right now, the median looks as though it has shifted over to Brett Kavanaugh for most issues, potentially Neil Gorsuch on others. And so I think that we are going to see some distinctions here. I think, you know, the administrative state is something that could be potentially under reconsideration at this point. How much deference do we give to executive agencies? That's one thing that might come under consideration. I do think it's likely that the court may look at, you know, affirmative action policies and race-based policies that are out there right now. We'll just have to see. I mean, if Democrats take over the House, the Senate, and the presidency, the court may have to sort of, you know, tread water for a couple of years and not, you know, not want to go too far to the right for fear of potential backlash from the political branches. But we will have to see on that.
Time for another caller. Bill is with us in Elgin, Illinois. Bill, hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I do see what Saul was saying, and he made a very legitimate point. But the point that I was going to make is this. You have liberal and Democrat. You have liberal and conservative. Each wants to stymie the other. And let's look at this situation here. Mitch McConnell refused to allow the voice of the people to go forward when Barack Obama had an opportunity to see the justice. My question to you then becomes this. If it means so much, dependent upon if a justice is placed by a liberal or a Democrat, doesn't that water down what is supposed to be called a law? Isn't a law like the law of gravity? It doesn't matter what happens. The law of gravity is the law. So water down what we consider the law.
Bill, thanks for the call. I think I see what you're getting at. How much wiggle room do justices have to impose an ideology in their interpretation of the law and, I guess, of the Constitution, Ryan?
Yeah. Well, I think Bill makes a good point here. And, you know, that point is that, honestly, we're asking too much of courts these days. I think if you went back in history and, you know, you talked to people 200 years ago and told them about how much authority we've given to courts to decide some of the most pressing political issues of the day, they would be absolutely astonished and frightened. You know, we do ask courts to resolve many, many issues right now that ought probably to be left to the political branches. And I think, you know, everybody is starting to see that now when we have these vacancies on the court and all hell breaks loose because, you know, one party's got to get their person on board. You know, that's kind of a problem, right? It suggests that everybody knows that these courts are answering the biggest questions of the day rather than us, the voters. And I think that's something that we should all be very, weary about.
Thanks for the call. And Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks a lot.
That's Ryan Owens, professor of political science and affiliate faculty at the UW Law School. Ryan studies the law, courts, and American political institutions. He joins us today for a look at Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation, now Justice Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with an ongoing series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. Wisconsin has seen a record number of COVID-19 related hospitalizations in the past 2 weeks. Dozens of patients are currently hospitalized in Dane County alone. While those numbers rose rapidly, they were also predictable, something ER nurse Mariah Clark reflected on after a seemingly slow day at work in late September.
It's the morning of September 25th, and a few days ago, I had one of the better shifts I'd had in a long time. We had enough staffing that I could spend time with a couple of patients, and there was a person who was just overwhelmed with the events of the world, and instead of just going through their discharge instructions and escorting them out and wishing them a good day and that they'd feel better, I sat with them for a little bit of extra time and talked about a time in my life when I had been overwhelmed and overwrought. One of the reasons I got into medicine was because I knew that it gave me the opportunity to really make a difference, whether that was by some dramatic life-saving, you know, bringing someone from the brink of death and seeing them walk out of the hospital weeks later, or whether it was by sitting with someone quietly. And that's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing. But even with all that, things are still getting busier. And, you know, I was listening to an NPR piece as I got ready for work the other day, and it was beautifully reflective. It was talking about the beginning of the pandemic, and people were talking about cheering healthcare workers or listening to stories of healthcare workers adapting, changing roles, sitting with people, facilitating family chats on tablets because families couldn't be at the bedsides of the sick. And part of me felt what they were going for, you know, that heartwarming note. And part of me was just aggravated because they were talking about it like it was past tense. Like, we are not still having iPad conversations with families and patients. Like, we are not bringing up end-of-life wishes. Like, we are not reusing single-use PPE. People are talking about it like it's past. And I assure you, whether you want to listen to me or whether you want to look at the data or whether you want to see the lines on my face from my mask or how sweaty I am after spending hours on end at a patient bedside, suctioning them and changing them and medicating them and comforting them, there's got to be a change, y'all. This is slowly grinding us into dirt. We could be enjoying a regular autumn. And instead, the pandemic is at its highest rate that it's been. We can do better. We need to do better. There's no excuse not to.
To hear more stories from this series, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Journalists spend a lot of time thinking about and rethinking about the service we provide around election time. In this election season, so much is different around the process and the circumstances. So how should the news media be preparing to cover the next week or so? You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you looking at this election differently this year? Did you vote using a different method than you normally do? Are you consuming news differently than in previous election seasons? And what are you hoping to hear next Tuesday from the media as voting goes on in person, as results start to come in? What are you worried about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Garrett M. Graff is Director of Cyber Initiatives for the Aspen Institute's Media and Technology Program, Aspen Digital. He's former editor of the Washingtonian Magazine and Politico Magazine. And he co-wrote a piece for the Columbia Journalism Review, along with Vivian Schiller, looking at election coverage. Garrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, one big lesson that I'm hearing a lot of people talk about, and you wrote about it, is I think the value of patience for all of us on election day and not being too eager to, quote unquote, call states as they go along. How important is that?
Yeah, this is going to be an unprecedented election in American history, let alone modern American history. Almost every single person in the country will be voting differently than they do before, either through the mail, through absentee ballots, or through the procedures and different polling places that have been set up because of the pandemic. And what that really means is that we can't expect the same level of results on election night that we are used to. And it's really important that the media and voters sort of understand that, expect that, and understand the role of the media in those first hours after the election. Because one of the things is, you know, we have gotten very used to results on election night being complete enough or comprehensive enough that they can be determinative. That news organizations are able to predict how many ballots are still to be counted, and they're able to project a winner. And even that language is really important. You know, the media has no official role in counting elections. And so any numbers you're getting from the news media on election night or even election week next week are going to be unofficial, and they will be subject to change as the week goes on and as further votes get tallied. And in a totally normal election, an election that's not in the middle of the pandemic, an election where there is no fraud or malfeasance, results change and trickle in over the course of the week as ballots are counted, recounted, as absentee totals are added, as military ballots are totaled. And, you know, in 2016, we saw 16 million votes come in after Donald Trump had been declared or projected as the winner of the election. And that's normal, and that people should expect that. And so they should expect that election results will change throughout next week. And none of that is actually a sign of fraud. That's the sign of the system working as expected and as intended to provide a careful and accurate vote count.
And you, one statement that you write in your piece that we mentioned is know your calendar. And I'm looking at a key part of the calendar. This, Tuesday is November 3rd. The official vote is certified. The official result in Wisconsin, anyway, is certified December 1st. So that gives a lot of time to count. And the notion that all the counting's done on election night, not even close to true based on that calendar.
Not even close to true. And in fact, that's why those state certification dates are set so far down the road. And it's really important that people not leap to the idea that, you know, if we don't know election results by midnight Tuesday or Wednesday morning, that they are late. There really isn't any such thing as late results in the election. It just sometimes might take a couple of days, a couple of weeks. And that's going to be particularly true in jurisdictions that are dealing with much larger absentee or vote by mail counts than they are used to.
Talking to Garrett Graff from the Aspen Institute, talking about a piece he co-wrote for Columbia Journalism Review, looking at media coverage of the election and what happens on election night and the days and maybe weeks afterward. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So some other possible scenarios to think about, Garrett, if one candidate or the other makes an early claim of victory before we have those kind of enough results to effectively project a winner. How can the media handle something like that?
Yeah, and this is actually, I think, one of the looming problems for next week is candidates effectively declaring premature or false claims of victory to set the narrative that changing election results are the election being stolen from them, whereas that's simply not going to be the case next week. You know, the Tuesday night results are not going to be determinative. It's going to take many states in the country through Thursday or even Friday to even figure out how many total ballots they have, let alone to figure out how they are counted. And what that means is that in that uncertainty, there is going to be an incentive, really, for candidates to start trying to set a narrative that the election is being stolen from them. And it's important that voters not buy into that. It's important that the media not buy into that. And it's important that local and state officials do everything they can to discourage that and to underscore that the legitimacy of the election hinges on counting all of the votes.
Now, in every election, there are a lot of polling stations and jurisdictions. There are going to be some small localized problems. For that kind of thing, how can that be reported on without making it look like, you know, that's the norm?
Yeah. And this is where, we forget just how many things go wrong during a normal election. You know, Americans will gather next week to vote in something like 230,000 places. And that means that even if 99.9% of all voting goes off totally fine without problem, there will still be literally hundreds of places where the power goes out, where someone forgets to plug in the voting machines, where an election official oversleeps and shows up late, where someone loses the voter roll. And that those are problems that happen totally normally. They're not necessarily evidence of fraud or misconduct. And those localized problems are not going to mean that the system writ large is unable to produce a legitimate decision about who the winner of the election is. And that's really important that the media not blow up localized problems to appear to be a systemic failure or to raise questions in the public's mind about a systemic failure. And that's going to be true sort of in part because, you know, for places that are voting in person next week, the socially distanced line is going to mean that, you know, even a relatively quick moving, well-staffed, well-resourced voting line might stretch for a couple of hundred yards. And the media is going to have to resist the urge to make it seem like, you know, every voting place in America is seeing literally lines out the door, when that's actually just a sign of the pandemic procedures in voting in this unprecedented circumstance.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hello. So here's my question. So if all of these votes aren't even, don't have to even be counted by December 1st being the deadline, and all these votes that come in after that night, the Electoral College has already voted and already given their electorate to a certain candidate. How can that be fair?
Okay, that is inaccurate, actually.
It's a great question, and this is where it's really important to understand and know your calendar over the next 6 weeks. So the dates that you need to know are your state certification deadline, which means in Wisconsin, in early December, the state officials will determine the official certified results. That needs to happen in every state across the country by December 8th. And then on December 14th is when that Electoral College actually meets all across the country to cast their official ballots for the presidency. So literally, as long as a state has wrapped up its count by December 8th, everything will proceed as normal across the country. That gives plenty of time for all of these ballots to be counted, for disputes around the ballots to be hashed out in court or at local election boards. And there's plenty of time in this process for the calendar to unfold exactly as anticipated, leading to a legitimate vote by the Electoral College on December 14th. So, you know, don't worry that if you're looking at results, you know, that are still changing Thursday, Friday, Saturday of next week, votes are still being tallied. That does not mean in any way that that the legitimacy of the election is being compromised, and it doesn't mean in any way that the states will miss the Electoral College deadline, because that's not until the middle of December.
Karen, thanks a lot for calling in. Good question. Garrett Graff is with us from the Aspen Institute, looking at media coverage of the election as it continues and closes on Tuesday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you look for from the media as the election gets closer? What do you want to hear? What do you want the media to be careful about on election night? And as we heard in the days after, as maybe vote tallies are or will be changing over time, call 800-642-1234 or join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with the Aspen Institute's Garrett Graff, talking about how the news media can cover the last day of this year's election and what comes that night and in the weeks to follow. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Garrett, I've been steering clear of a term right now. Election Day, your colleague who co-wrote that piece has written another thing saying, you know, we're already having Election Day right now. Is it misleading to just call Tuesday Election Day anymore?
Yeah, and certainly that appears to be the true this case, and that I think we need to move towards thinking about this really as more election season, and that the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November isn't election day so much as it is the last day of election or the last day of voting. Because what you're seeing this year is just this incredible record turnout by mail, in-person early voting, absentee balloting. And it looks quite likely that more than half of all the people who vote in this election will have already done so before next Tuesday. And that I think it is important for the media to make that clear, in part because every one of those votes is equally valid, and that there is I think there is a tendency to think of people who vote on election day as somehow sort of having more valid votes than people who vote in other ways, when that's simply not the case. That's not the law, and it's certainly not the trend of early voting across the country. Even before this year, nearly a third of all Americans in 2016 who voted did so early.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Madison. Brad, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Brad?
My comment was just, as Americans, we want what we want now, right? We want it when we want it now. And I think the biggest thing that we need to focus on is a counter narrative. I think that when, as the votes are being counted, every minute past November 3rd, on November 4th, if people believe that there's fraud, the narrative in their heads will be, this just gives people time to commit more fraud. Whereas I think assurances that no fraud is being committed they're not going to believe it. So I would say that the counter narrative needs to be just count all the votes. That's my comment.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. Garrett?
Yeah, and I think, Brad, you're absolutely right that the, we have this idea from, a century ago that the fact that votes have not been officially reported from a given precinct means that, this is some sort of Chicago-style shenanigans where, an entire cemetery is being stuffed into the ballot box once they figure out what the margin of victory that they need to overcome is. And the truth of the matter is that election fraud in modern elections is vanishingly small. There have been numerous studies, and they all show that fraud in American election, regardless of how it's carried out, whether it's by mail or in person, accounts for a few thousandths or tens of thousandths of a single percent of the vote. Washington State, for instance, found that in its most recent midterm election, Washington State, a state that conducts its entire election by mail, out of about 3.4 million votes, it had about 130 fraudulent votes, sort of about 0.0025% fraud, which is an incredibly small number. And in many ways, it's important that the media emphasize how both rare fraud actually is, and that even reports of problems actually generally point to their solutions. So one example of this is in Georgia this summer, there were 1,000 people who double voted in the summer primary in Georgia. But what most people sort of failed to understand when they heard that number is not only that those 1,000 voters represented just a tiny fraction of a percent of the total voters, but that the double votes were actually caught by the very mechanisms in place to prevent such instances. And as far as investigators have found, only one of those double voters was known to have malign intentions. So we have systems in place to prevent fraud, And when those systems report fraud, that's actually a sign that the system worked, not that the system failed.
What happens on election night and the day after as rumors are going around on social media? Maybe a candidate is questioning the legitimacy of an election. Probably malign actors are spreading misinformation about what's going on. How can the media keep up with that?
Yeah, and you mentioned sort of one thing that is important to talk about in this context that we haven't really talked about, which is the malign actors, foreign adversaries, domestic troublemakers, who might try to step into an information vacuum on election night with what people call a perception hack, which is trying to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election. It is in many ways easier to pretend that you hacked the election than it is to actually hack the election. And so people should be especially wary of stories between now and the election or the period after the election where you have someone coming out and saying that they hacked the election and offering what could even look like very convincing proof without sort of understanding the context, because it is incredibly hard to actually execute these attacks. It is nearly impossible, given the decentralized nature of American elections, to hack or attack the U.S. election at scales, enough to actually matter in a national election. And so, you might very well see malign actors stepping out over the coming days to say, hey, look, here's a video of me hacking a voting machine in Broward County, Florida. And that is more likely than not actually a fake. And that's actually precisely what the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI warned about last week, which was we saw Iran sending targeted emails pretending to be from the white nationalist group Proud Boys to voters in states like Alaska and Florida, saying, hey, we know you're a Democratic voter. You need to support Trump or else. And while it looked like that was the result of stealing voter information, that voter data is actually publicly available and easily available, and that there is no sign that Iran was actually able to penetrate voting systems in a meaningful way.
That's all the time we have. Garrett, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Garrett M. Graff is Director of Cyber Initiatives for the Aspen Institute's Media and Technology Program, Aspen Digital. We talked with him today about a piece he co-wrote for the Columbia Journalism Review on media coverage as the election comes to an end.